From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Seems like everybody loves the Pope these days. His affection for the poor, his humility, his sense of humor. And people are always trying to guess, is he liberal or is he conservative? Because there's evidence for both. He's opposed to gay marriage, for example, on theological grounds. But he's in favor of same-sex civil unions because he says it's a matter of civil rights. The religion writer Paul Vallely says asking if the Pope is liberal or conservative is asking the wrong question because he's a man of complexity who's comfortable with tradition on one hand and modernity on the other. So he represents a challenge to both sides. Vallely's new book tries to make sense of all of this, and he's joining us today to talk about the man who became Pope Francis. After the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to join us at Abravanel Hall the evening of September 24th for a conversation with Michael Lewis, one of the best nonfiction writers ever. And it's easy to make that case. I'll just mention the titles of some of his books: Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short. This is not a radio program. The Hinckley Institute of Politics is bringing Lewis here at the end of the month, and he's joining me on stage. So we hope you'll be with us September 24th. For details, go to radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be pretty easy to put Pope Francis on a pedestal. I mean, he's such a likable guy. The stories of him embracing and kissing a severely disfigured man, of him washing the feet of inmates, publicly going to confession. But the writer Paul Vallely says it's important to remember the flaws in Pope Francis's life, which the man himself fully embraces, and also the changes he's made in his life. Vallely's new book portrays these changes as a sign of strength, a man willing to learn from his mistakes. In fact, a man, Vallely says, who was reshaped and revitalized by those errors and changes. Vallely writes that Francis has changed himself, and now he wants the Catholic Church to change in the same way. Paul Vallely is joining us today to explore the story of the man who became Pope Francis. Paul Vallely is a journalist, a commentator on politics, ethics, and religion. He's written for the London Times, for the New York Times, and other newspapers. He's currently a visiting professor in public ethics and media at the University of Chester. He's also a senior fellow at the Brooks World Poverty Institute at the University of Manchester. His book is called Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism, and we should mention it's a sequel to his book Pope Francis, Untying the Knots. Paul Vallely is in New York and joining us today from the studios of NPR there. And Paul Vallely, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with the the label. A lot of people are trying to figure out the Pope by sort of guessing at his ideology. Is he a liberal? Is he a conservative? But you say in the book that's the wrong question. He's radical, but not a liberal, a doctrinal conservative, but he's also where do you sort of put him then, if we can put him somewhere?
Well, you know, the old joke is the Pope a Catholic? Well, this Pope is a Catholic. And, you know, a Catholic is someone who holds to a particular set of doctrines. And this Pope holds to the same set of doctrines as the last Pope and the Pope before him. He's changed the atmosphere completely, but he's not changed any of the teachings. And so in that sense, you can say that he's orthodox, or you could say he's conservative if you want to look at it from a secular liberal point of view. But he's exactly what you would expect in terms of what he teaches. It's the way he teaches that's so different. That's the revolution.
What do you mean by that, the way he teaches?
Well, I'll give you an example. He did a virtual audience, it was called, with some U.S. citizens, school students in Chicago, homeless people in Los Angeles, and immigrants on the Texas-Mexico border. And it was a two-way, so they could hear him and he could hear them. Mm. And there was one woman who stood up and said that she'd made a mess of her life, she'd made the wrong decisions, she'd made life hard for her two daughters. And she clearly felt bad. She was in tears talking to the Pope. And the Pope said, whoa, no, you are a brave woman. You've looked after these two girls. You could have had an abortion, but you didn't. You've brought them into the world and you've looked after them. You've done your best. You're courageous. You should carry on. You should be courageous because God is with you. And he was completely affirming of her in that situation. Now, the reason I mention that story is that if you look at previous popes, they would have been much more concerned with the rules and with condemning bad behavior and saying this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. This pope has exactly the same view as abortion as the other popes, that it's wrong, that it's a sin. But instead of wagging his finger at someone, in the case of this woman, he puts his arm around her, metaphorically. And he says, no, you've done the right thing. So he's not changing the teaching at all, but the whole atmosphere is warm, loving, merciful, compassionate, and about bringing people into the embrace of the church rather than saying, oh, well, you can't be in it for the following reasons because you're not perfect.
Mm. I want to get to a story. There are so many stories in the book, and I want to get to as many as we can. You tell the story of before he's elected. In fact, he's on his way off to Rome for the conclave to elect this new pope after Pope Benedict resigns. And he has with him, I like this little diversion because I think it tells a lot about him. He has with him, on him, a very dingy pair of black shoes. Would you tell that part of the story? This is an interesting little bit. I think it says a lot about Francis.
Yeah, Francis is a man who thinks you only need one pair of shoes, and the poor people only have one pair of shoes, and some of them don't have any shoes at all. So he was on his way to Rome, and the people who worked with him said, look at the state of his shoes. He can't go to Rome in those battered old black shoes. And so they had a whip round and a collection, and they bought him a pair of new shoes. And Francis said, thank you very much for those. And then he left them in his room and went off to Rome in his old shoes. Now, Francis says these shoes are comfortable because he's got a sciatica, so he walks in a way that he needs shoes that are kind of orthopedic or that comfortable for him. And these shoes, old shoes, were comfortable, and so he wasn't gonna even take the new shoes. And then, of course, when he gets to Rome, he gets elected pope, and they take him off to get dressed up, and there's a kind of small, medium, and large white cassock for him to try, and then there's various pairs of red shoes because the last pope, Benedict, brought back the tradition of popes wearing red shoes. This goes back to ancient Rome when only the emperor and the empress could wear red shoes. So the pope, it was a kind of status symbol. So Bergoglio, as he was before he was pope, mm-hmm. takes one look at these shoes. He says, I'm not wearing those red shoes. These will do me. And he points to these scruffy old shoes. And a few weeks later, his shoe repairer in Buenos Aires gets a phone call, and he says, "Hi, it's Bergoglio here, and it's the Pope ringing up." And he says, "Do you think you could repair my shoes? Because they are getting a bit." And the man said, "Well, I can have a go, but really, you need a new pair of shoes." And he said, okay, give me the new shoes and make them like the old shoes. He says, but make sure they're black, not red.
Right. Let's talk about what happens there in Rome before Bergoglio is elected. He books himself into a room, into a sort of a simple priest's hostel. He's 76 now, had been passed over, and I don't think a lot of people realize just how close he was to being elected pope. Beforehand,
yeah, the time before he was the number two choice. You know, Cardinal Ratzinger was elected and became Benedict XVI, but the runner up was Bergoglio, and not many people knew that. And the few people who did know it thought, well, he's not in with a chance because you know once you've missed the boat, you don't get a second chance at being pope. Well, they were wrong.
Yeah. What's so interesting about that moment is you talk about how there's this sense after Ratzinger has Benedict has resigned, there's this sense among the cardinals who are meeting now to elect this new pope that it's time for the church to leave behind, you know, the old-fashioned culture wars. And so these two camps emerge, you write about. One wants to kind of defend the Curia, the governing body of the church. The other is very interested in reforming the Vatican. And so that's sort of the atmosphere going on, as this vote is going to take place. And I wanted you to explain what happens here, because they have these gatherings where the cardinals speak to each other, these congregationals, I think they're called.
And yeah, congregations.
Congregations, forgive me. And Bergoglio gives this speech, which seems to make a big difference. Would you tell that story?
Yeah, before they have a vote in what's called a conclave, where they get locked in and the white smoke comes up and all that, before they have that, they have general meetings, which they call congregations, and all the cardinals can go to that, not just the ones who vote, because when you're 80, you can't vote anymore, but the older cardinals can come to these conversations, and they have conversations about what kind of man do we need to be pope this time. And they don't mention names, but it's a kind of where are we? There were three things that were the reasons that they elected Bergoglio. One was that there'd been this huge scandal with a thing called VatiLeaks, where the previous Pope's butler had leaked some documents to journalists, which he'd been given by Benedict to be shredded, but he leaked them. And he leaked them kind of out of loyalty rather than out as an act of treachery, because he thought that the court officials in Rome were disregarding Benedict and undermining him. And he wanted this to come out in the open, so he leaked these documents, and they showed things like things that Benedict wanted not happening, or other people, you know, it was all intrigue and infighting, like a court, you know, a royal court.
Right.
And everyone was aware of this VatiLeaks thing, and the butler went on trial, and a lot of dirt came out as a result of that. So Pope Benedict went to three top cardinals who were over 18, couldn't vote for the next pope, and he said to them, "I want you to investigate this." And they investigated this whole scandal. And an interesting side story: that when the new pope was elected, and the old pope and the new pope met in their white robes in Castel Gandolfo, which is the summer residence, which is where Benedict was living in retirement, there's a photo of them. And they're sitting at chairs either side of this low coffee table, and there's a white box on this coffee table. And nobody made any remark about this at the time the picture was published. But that white box was the report of the three cardinals into all the intrigue and infighting that was going on in the Vatican. And this box is like 2 foot high and 2 foot wide, and it's full of the witness statements that they took, and on the top there was a little white envelope with the conclusions in it. And when Benedict had read this, he thought, I mean, he wasn't feeling very well anyway. He'd fallen over. This wasn't known. This is in the book. He'd fallen over in a bathroom when he was on a trip to Cuba and Mexico, and banged his head. So he was feeling, you know, I'm getting too old, I'm too frail. Then this massive box comes and he thinks, I can't handle this. And he's then the first pope for 500 years to resign. He just resigns. Amazing, an amazing act, a very kind of modern act, because it treated the pope like, you know, it's a job, and if you can't do it, you step aside for the next one. And it was a revolutionary act by Benedict. So in this box is this VatiLeaks stuff, and all the cardinals know about this. And in these general congregations, they're all saying, "What's in this report? What's in this report?" And they're asking the three cardinals who did the report, and the cardinals are saying, "No, we're not saying. It's for the next pope. We're sworn to silence on this." But they all knew roughly what the problem was because of all the VatiLeaks scandal. So that was a big issue. Then the second big issue was the Vatican Bank, which had become a byword for scandal and dysfunction, and it was linked to the mafia and money laundering and all kinds of allegations. And they knew that needed clearing up. Benedict had tried to clear that up, but he'd been outmaneuvered by the vested interests in the Vatican, who didn't want any change. And that was part of why the butler had leaked the stuff. So these two big issues, the Curia, the organisation, and the bank. And then the third thing. When it was his turn, Bergoglio stood up and he said, we need reforms, but we must look outwards, not look inwards. If the church looks inwards and becomes self-referential, that was the phrase he used, then, you know, it's a dying church. We need to get out of the sacristy, into the streets, get the message of the gospel out to the peripheries. That's his favourite word, the peripheries. And he means the margins, the geographical margins, but also the kind of existential margins where, you know, where people live at the bottom of the heap. We need to get the gospel out there, and we've got to forget this kind of looking at the problems of the church all the time. And he used the this amazing image. In Latin, it's called Mysterium Lunae, the mystery of the moon. And the mystery of the moon is that it has no light. All the light it sheds on the earth is a reflection of the sun. And this is a parallel for the church. The church has no light. It just reflects the light of Christ. And there were too many people in the church who'd begun to think that the church had its own light. And Bergoglio was saying, no, we have to go out and we have to get the message of Christ to people. And the reforms have to be done in that spirit. And as he sat down, the Cardinal of Vienna turned to the man next to him and said, this is the man.
Yeah.
This is the man to be Pope.
Pope Francis, as you say in your book, presents himself to the world as this icon of simplicity and humility. And it seems as though most of that is clearly authentic, but he's very much always been that way. But you also write in the book that it can be a complex business being simple, and that some of these gestures that he makes are carefully planned, not fake or phony, but carefully planned, because you say he gets this idea that actions speak more eloquently than words. Would you talk a little? There's a great story about a black briefcase.
Yeah,
it seems
well,
to illustrate
you see, the Pope
that.
The Pope, in one sense, anyone who knew him in Argentina isn't surprised by lots of it. He used to get the subway in Argentina. He got rid of the papal chauffeur, or he gave him a new job, and he used to just take the bus or the subway. He lived in two rooms in the diocesan offices in Argentina, just like now he lives in the Vatican hostel instead of in the papal palace. So some of this is stuff that you know, it's just the way that he's learned how to be a disciple of Christ.
Right.
But some of it is he knows, he understands the potency of symbols and gestures, and so he knows what he's doing. The briefcase story was told to me by one official in the Vatican, and it was about he's going off on a visit, his first visit abroad, and he gets to the airport and he's talking to the Prime Minister of Italy and all this kind of thing, and he turns to one of his aides and says, where's my briefcase? And they said, oh, don't worry, it's been taken on the plane. It's been taken on already. He said, no, I need to take it on. They said, well, it's on already, there's no need.
Right.
And he said, no. He says, you don't understand. Go and get the briefcase and bring it to me. So they go and get the briefcase. No one notices this. They give it to him. And then suddenly he looks relieved and he says, right, OK, right, I'm ready now. And he says goodbye to the Prime Minister and he goes up the tarmac and all the photographers are taking pictures. And on the plane, the press corps are all looking out the window and they're saying, look at that. The Pope's carrying his own bag. That's amazing, because popes never carried their own bags.
Yeah.
And so when it was the press conference on the plane, somebody said to him, what's in the bag? What's in the bag? And he said, well, you know, my razor, my shaving things, the Bible, a book to read, a book about St. Teresa. I'm very fond of St. Teresa, you know. and they all look like, he said, it's not got the keys to the nuclear bomb in or anything.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of gobsmacked by this. And he says, look, it's just, I'm a normal man with a normal bag going on a normal trip. This is what you have to get used to. The Pope is a normal man. And in Rome, where they have to dress everything up, they call this the scandal of normalcy. The idea it's a scandal that the Pope's normal. So this Pope is ordinary, except of course he's extraordinary.
It's interesting all the reverence that's paid to this Pope so far, and you get why. I mean, all of his gestures to the poor and this humility and all of those kinds of things. But let's talk a little bit about your book, because this is one of the things you've tried to avoid, is as you say, this reverential approach. Because a big theme in his life, and we'll get to this a little bit later in the program, are the things that he's gone through, particularly the insight that you really work through in this new book. And that is his experience is sort of off in the sort of spiritual or political wilderness, really. Cordoba, this experience that he has where he really seems to change, and that's an important part. But this is something, I guess, this is one of the things that really interests you about this man.
Well, yeah, I wanted to do. I'm a journalist, you know. I'm not a spin doctor for the church. I wanted to tell the truth, although, you know, Jesus says the truth will set you free. But I wanted to do like a warts and all portrait of this man, because he came out on the balcony, and And the first thing he said was, before I give you a blessing, I want you to bless me. And he bowed down and he wanted the people to pray over him. Well, that was an extraordinary change. Mm. And then the next day in the newspapers, we get all these stories from Argentina about how he'd been he'd betrayed two of his own Jesuits to a military death squad. When, and I thought, how can these two things possibly be true? Which one of them is true? So I thought, well, I'll go off to Argentina and I'll find out. And so I wanted to get a portrait which you know, was warts and all. Because in an interview, the Pope said, in his time as leader of the Jesuits, he made hundreds of errors. And he emphasised that twice. It wasn't a kind of rhetorical flourish. He meant it, hundreds of errors. And yet, if you read some of these biographies that are written about the Pope, you'd be hard to find any of these hundreds of errors in, yeah. Because they're all kind of wanting to be too reverential and make out that you know, he's a wonderful figure and he's just the same as Pope Benedict. And, you know, and I didn't want that. I wanted to tell the truth about him.
Mm. It's interesting how many you talk about the press coverage, how the press, there's this kind of storyline that they have in mind and that they don't like to go beyond it. And there are a lot of urban myths that have circulated about this pope. Maybe you could mention one or two of them. This idea that he sort of goes off in disguise as the pope and works
in
the streets.
Yeah, well, people love the idea. Apparently, he did go off the first night that he was elected pope. He couldn't sleep, and he got up and put his old black clothes. He'd taken his white clothes off to go to bed, and he put his old black clothes on, his old Bergoglio clothes, and he went out, and the the staff were horrified and thought, what's he doing? Has he forgotten his pope or what? and he said, I can't sleep. Is there a car available? And they found this little Fiat car, and he went in it and he drove round the streets of Rome watching everybody celebrating the new pope. Now, I'm told that's a true story, but there are lots of similar stories that aren't true, mm-hmm. like that he gets dressed up at, and he goes out at night and feeds the poor, kind of stories that people think ought to be true, you know. And there's a story which I tried to work out whether it's true or not, and I couldn't pin it down, but it's a story about how on the first night he came out in the middle of the night, and he found a Swiss guard standing outside his door, because the Swiss guard are the people who guard the Pope.
Right.
And he said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm your guard. He said, have you been here all night? And he said, yeah, that's my job. He said, and the Pope disappears, goes back into his room, and he comes out with a chair. He says, here, sit down. You can't stand there all night. You need a chair. And the Swiss guard says, oh, I'm not allowed to. You know, I'm under orders, you know. And he says, well, whose orders? He says, oh, the captain of the guard. And the Pope says, well, he's just the captain of the guard. I'm the Pope and I'm telling you to sit down. So this bloke sits down, and then the Pope goes and makes him a jelly sandwich because he thinks he must be hungry. Now, I tried to find out if this story was true, and I couldn't, you know, substantiate it. But I put it in the book as an example of the kind of myth making, the kind of stories that people want to be true. And also because the man who was the Pope's aide for 8 years in Buenos Aires referred to this story. He said, that's a very interesting story. He says, because you've got the two halves of Bergoglio summed up in that. On the one hand, he's the kind, simple, generous man saying, oh, sit down, you need a chair. But he's also the man who says, I'm the Pope, do what I say.
Right.
And it was a revealing story for that reason. So I include it in the book, and I say it, we don't know whether it's true or not. But and I quote this chap, Guillermo Marco, who's a priest in Argentina, you know, with his interpretation of why that story is important. So that's the thing about myths. They are things which people feel are poetically true, even if they're not really true.
Paul Vallely is with us. His book is called Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Pope Francis, who is, of course, coming to the United States this week. The journalist Paul Vallely is our guest. He's been examining these competing claims about the Pope. Liberals say he's brought a new sense of freedom and candor. Conservatives say he's bringing division and uncertainty to the church. We're also looking at the Pope's backstory today to find clues about his strategy, if in fact he has one. Paul Vallely's book is called Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. Let me ask you about that strategy. This is one of the things you write about in the book. You say that it's unclear if he actually has a strategy or whether that's entirely clear right now. What do you think?
Well, he's got certainly an outline strategy, but he does kind of make it up as he goes along, or as he would put it, he allows the Holy Spirit to blow through the dusty corridors of the Vatican in places it hasn't blown for a long, long time. But one of the things that there's a problem about the Pope is that people look at him on this kind of is he a liberal, is he a conservative spectrum. And that's only one kind of divide within the church. Yeah. There's another important divide, and it's do you think the church should be run from the centre by the Vatican, or do you think it should be run from the local areas, the local churches, and the Vatican should just kind of be a service servant at the centre? People often assume that if you're a conservative, you're a centraliser, and if you're a liberal, you're out on the fringes person. But that's not true. There are a lot of conservative people who are conservative on doctrine, but who think that the church shouldn't be run from the middle. So you've got that kind of divide. You've also got a divide on the how people worship. Should they be traditional, the Latin Mass, Gregorian chant, and so forth, or should it be like folk songs and things that are accessible to ordinary people? And you've got divides on that. So there are lots of divides within the church, and they don't all kind of stack up in the same way. And we're seeing that with this Pope, who's orthodox on doctrine but liberal on these signals that he sends in, radical, revolutionary almost in some ways. We're seeing a richer, more complex picture of the church than perhaps people have been used to from the old culture wars model.
Let's talk a little bit about his life in Argentina. His grandmother arrives in Argentina from Italy in 1929. She's an important figure in his life. And Bergoglio was raised, you say, on pasta and in a culture that was distinctly Italian, the first of five kids. But you also say he was the only one who took the family's traditions most to heart. Would you talk a little bit about that? He had a pretty happy childhood, I guess.
Yeah, they were. I mean, it's interesting now he talks about migration and refugee crisis, because he's the son of a migrant. His dad and his grandparents came over from Italy. They arrived. They had a bit of money, and his uncles were there, and they got involved in the family business. But there was a recession, a complete crash, and they lost everything. So they were quite. I mean, they weren't dirt poor, but they had no holidays. They had no car. He wore hand-me-down clothes, and so he understands, what life is like for people who are struggling. But it was very rich in terms of its family life and its religious life. His grandma looked after him, took him every day to her house because his mum was ill at one point. And she had four other kids. So, in one way, he was brought up by his grandma. I mean, he used to go home every evening, but Grandma Rosa was the person who taught him how to pray and taught him all the stories about the saints and all of the. When he became a Jesuit later on, the Jesuits are very intellectual order, and a lot of them are very kind of dismissive of what they see as peasant superstitions, with processions and statues and kissing things and medals. But Bergoglio is very keen on all that, because that was how he was brought up. And he thinks that the richer you get and the more educated you get, the more you get away from the simple things that connect you to God. So his background has really been important in shaping the kind of person that he is.
Loved faith, of course, but he also loved other things. He was a big fan, he still is, I guess, of soccer, liked to dance the tango, you say.
And there's another dance which is a kind of more primitive form of the tango, which he preferred. He was a regular guy. He was a bouncer outside a nightclub at one point. Not the kind of things you expect from a Pope.
No,
but
tell the story. I wanted to get you to tell the story of he's actually planning to propose to one of the girls at this picnic he's going to, and this was in a morning in September. But then something happens along the way. Would you tell us that story? Because this is something transformed in his life, and he makes this decision to go into the priesthood.
Yeah, he was on his way to the school picnic, and he went past church, and he thought he would just pop in and say a prayer. And he saw this new priest there he hadn't seen before, and there was something about this priest which has had a kind of charismatic or magnetic quality. And he was drawn to him, and he went into the confessional and had his confession heard by this priest. And at some point in that, he was just suddenly seized with the notion that he wanted to be a priest, and that he shouldn't go off and, you know, propose to the girl and get married. That wasn't for him. He should become a priest, and he left the church, and he didn't go to the picnic. He went home, and that was the start of his vocation and his journey to the priesthood.
Well, another thing you write about is Bergoglio's early days as a priest in his role.
But sorry, let me just tell you one more thing on that.
Please.
Interestingly, when he was in the seminary and he was a priest, he went to one family wedding, and there was a girl there, somewhere about 19 or 20 or whatever, and she was very, very pretty and very clever and very funny. And he really, you know, was challenged by her because he thought, that would be the woman for me. And And he thought, and it took him a week. He went back to the seminary and he prayed for a week before he realized, no, he did want to be a priest, and that wasn't for him. So that kind of, you know, he's got that red-blooded thing in him, that which, again, it all makes him feel like a more normal person.
Yeah. You also tell in his early days as a Jesuit how he seems like he was a bit of a meddler and maybe kind of a pain. I mean, there's one story how this parcel of pastries arrives. Would you tell that story?
You need to have a bit of background before you can tell that story. And the background is that the Jesuits were divided between this is the middle of the Cold War. The Jesuits were divided by those who wanted to go out and take this vision of the Second Vatican Council and work among the poor and live among the poor. And they developed what was called liberation theology, which was about bringing a spiritual. Not just spiritual change, but political and economic change to people, and letting them take control of their own lives. And then there was a group in the Jesuits who said, no, we don't want to be doing that. That will upset the military if we do that, and they'll think we're all revolutionaries, and we should just stick to our job of teaching rich kids and, teaching and keeping with our old traditional spirituality. And the division between the two was such that the conservative group went to the Jesuit headquarters in Rome and said, the man who's in charge at the moment is leading us all down the wrong path, and he needs to be replaced. And it was like a coup, you know, an internal revolution. And the Jesuits in Rome said, okay, we'll change him. And the obvious man to change him to had been just killed in a car crash. So they said, well, what about Bergoglio? Everyone likes him. He's very charismatic and dynamic. And so Bergoglio, at the age of 36, was put in charge of the entire country, all the Jesuits in Argentina and in Uruguay next door. Massive job. And they thought he would heal the division. But what he did was he made the division worse. And he cracked down on liberation theology. And he brought back, you know, more traditional ways of worship and formation for the priests and so forth. And for 15 years, he kind of ruled the roost in one position or another as the Jesuit leader, until the point came where more Jesuits were of the persuasion they should be working with the poor than the other lot. And they got rid of him. They sent him off to Cordoba.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that they sent him off to Cordoba was because, first of all, he was just told, well, you're not a leader anymore, so you're just an ordinary Joe, you're an ordinary priest in the community. And he couldn't get his head around that. He kept telling the new leaders, the principal of the college, the head of the house that he lived in, he kept telling them what they were doing wrong and what they ought to be doing. And the story about the pastries is one of those. There's a knock on the door, and a gift has come from a friend of the Jesuits, and a big tray of pastries, and the priest takes it, and he's just about to take it down to the kitchen, and Bergoglio appears and says, oh, what are you doing with that big tray of pastries? You should take that down to the kitchen, and you should share it with the staff. And the bloke who's carrying it says, Hang on a minute. I don't need you to tell me to share that. I was going down to the kitchen anyway. Right. And it was a kind of thing, story like that, events like that were like the final straw. And they sent him into like a wilderness period. Right. He was sent off to Cordoba, which is the second city in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, about 400 miles away from Buenos Aires. And he lived there like on his own for 2 years. And he wasn't allowed to kind of say mass in public, or he just had to kind of, he was like being punished really, right, or being purified, as people later put it. And he underwent this kind of dark night of the soul. And he said in his first interview as Pope, he said, I underwent a great inner crisis in Cordoba. And when he came back from Cordoba, this man who'd been a rigid authoritarian, very strict disciplinarian, very old-fashioned in lots of ways, had been transformed into this kinder, more gentle, listening person who wanted people to participate, didn't just want to tell them what to do. And his leadership style had been entirely changed. And he became a bishop in Buenos Aires, and he went to work in the slums, spent a lot of his time in the slums. And the direct experience of meeting poor people. And, you know, in the slums, the big problems there were the drugs and there was a lot of prostitution. And he came to understand that a drug dealer or a prostitute weren't just people who caused trouble. There were people who had problems of their own, and he could see there was a kind of complexity to it. And it all made him a kind of more compassionate and gentler person into the Pope we've seen today. And it seems to me that what he's doing now is that he's trying to make the church change in the way that he changed.
There's this story you tell of a man who had lost an election and asked Bergoglio how he should cope with the loss. And Bergoglio said, "Live in your exile. I lived in mine." So we all go through those experiences. You go into exile and you can either make something of it or not. And he changed. And I guess that's what seems to have defined him now.
Yeah, and he said to that same politician, when you come out of your exile, you'll be a more merciful and kinder person. Mm.
I read this profile of the Pope early on from James Carroll, who wrote for The New Yorker, and who described Francis as someone who views the church as a field hospital after a battle. And there's this quote by the Pope who says, "The thing the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and warm the hearts of the faithful." He says it's useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol or about the level of his blood sugars. You have to heal wounds first, and then we can talk about everything else. Do you think that expresses where he is, this idea of his
very
philosophy?
Much so. I mean, that is Francis's own metaphor, and James Carroll quoted it. But Francis came up with this idea of the field hospital. And, I mean, that's why he said in that same first interview, he said, the church has been obsessed with issues like abortion, gay marriage, contraception. And that shocked a lot of conservatives. But he wasn't saying that he disagreed with the church teaching on abortion or gay marriage or whatever. He was just saying we shouldn't be focused on that. Yeah. We should be focused on other things, this field hospital, healing the wounds, reaching out to people. And what are the problems that people have? And this culture wars has circulated around or focused around these sexual ethics issues. And this Pope has switched the whole focus from sex to money, and that's why a lot of conservatives in the United States, in particular, you know, the world's richest country, that's why they're not happy with that, because you know it's easy to sign up to being a Catholic if all you've got to do is say you're against abortion or against gay marriage or whatever. Those don't really hurt you or cost you. If you're a rich person and you're being told that you need to rethink your relationship with the poor, the powerful people exploit poor people, the poor people at the bottom of the heap are excluded by the present economic system, and something needs to change, then you start to think, whoa, this is going to hit me in my pocketbook.
Paul Vallely is with us. His book is Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Paul Vallely. We're talking about his new book, Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. He's joining us from the studios of NPR New York. Pope Francis is making this effort to, of course, reform the Vatican Bank. You write all about that. Remake the Vatican bureaucracy. But there's quite an intense bit of resistance going on. In fact, you say in the book, in some quarters, it's threatening to become an open revolt. How do you identify that resistance? Can you identify names or people, or is it more difficult to sort of assess that pushback from within?
Well, there's two kinds of pushback. When he's reforming the Vatican Bank or the Vatican bureaucracy, or when he's working on his commission for changing the church's record on sex abuse, mm-hmm. there's a lot of internal opposition. Cardinal O'Malley of Boston, who's the head of that sex abuse commission, said to its members at the first meeting, he said, "You've got to understand there's been more resistance to the establishment of this committee than anything in the Vatican apart from the reform of the finances."
Wow.
So there's a kind of, you know, hidden civil war going on with people who are dragging their feet and trying to obstruct things, delay things, or object to measures on grounds of technicalities or whatever. On some of those areas, like the Vatican Bank, Francis has been ruthless. Anybody who stood in the way, he's just replaced them, had them chopped out. And, on one occasion, he got rid of a board of five cardinals, in one fell swoop, because he thought they were an obstacle to process. So he can be quite ruthless. But in some of the areas, like the reform of the church bureaucracy, he's got to proceed a little more cautiously. Because what he's inherited is a bureaucracy which is staunchly conservative, and he wants to take the church not to the left, but he wants to take the church back to the middle, as he would see it. And so he's replaced some of these figures. So someone like Cardinal Burke, the American cardinal, who was a key figure on the body that appointed bishops around the world, there were quite a few of those, were removed very early on because the Pope thought that they were producing the wrong kind of bishops, too many culture war bishops and not enough pastoral care, not enough bishops who smelled of their sheep, as his phrase put it. And again, when Cardinal Burke continued his public resistance, the Pope demoted him from his job as head of the Vatican Supreme Court, and now he's not even going to be a member of the Synod of Bishops. The Synod of Bishops is the place where you see more open disagreement. He used this. Case that's a totemic thing in the Catholic Church. Can Catholics who are divorced and remarried, can they take communion? Yeah. The rules say they can't, although in practice a lot of them just ignore that and do. The Pope wants those rules to change. I say in the book, I've spoken to several people who talked to him privately about this, and he's quite clear he wants the rules to change. But he doesn't just want to kind of issue a papal fiat like an old-style, medieval monarch and say this is what's going to happen. He wants the church to discuss it and to arrive at a decision which will, people can come along with. And so he made that the key issue at the Synod of Bishops. The Synod of Bishops is very important to him because he wants the church to change the way it makes decisions. He doesn't want it to be like the Pope is the king and everyone does what he says. He wants it to be a more consensual, he wouldn't use the word democratic, but that's essentially what it is. He wants to bring the bishops into this democratic process. And just last week, he announced that he wants his cardinal advisors. He's got a council of nine cardinal advisors. He wants them to look at how bishops are appointed, because that was something the Second Vatican Council said had to happen, and it never has. So there's lots of kind of revolutionary things in this process, which is not changing doctrine, but it's changing process, and it's accentuating this collegiality. So there are battle lines forming there between conservatives and these pastoral open people who... And the Pope seems quite happy about that. Well, when Cardinal Casper, who's in favour of this change on communion, said to Casper, can you go and kind of do an introduction to this subject to the College of Cardinals. And Casper said, oh, you realise if I do that, there'll be a huge controversy. And the Pope said, yeah, good, good, that's what we want. And then when the Synod of Bishops happened, at the beginning of the Synod of Bishops, the Pope said to them, now I want you all to speak boldly, listen with humility, but speak boldly. I don't want anybody coming up afterwards and saying, oh, well, I didn't say so-and-so because I thought the Pope wouldn't like it. Say whatever you think. And they did. Mm. And afterwards he said, well, you know, this is healthy. This is debate. In the past, the Church thought that debate was dissent. But, you know, no, let's have all the views out and let's have them out in the open. And that's much, much healthier. Now, you can see that a lot of people who are kind of old style, let's get everything organised, conservative figures, think that this is chaos and confusion. The Pope thinks it's not chaos and confusion. It's just healthy debate.
So this is what you mean when you write the Church is no longer talking in code, but speaking plainly. He wants to just let's come out and say it.
Yeah, well, that's what happened at the Synod of Bishops last October. And next month, there's another synod, which will carry on that work. And then after that, there's what the Pope's called a Year of Mercy, which I think we'll get a decision next month on some of these issues. But I think they will kind of play out through the Year of Mercy. And we will see some more compassionate and open pastoral gestures. So the Pope doesn't want people to think that they can just go around getting divorced. He wants them to think that marriage is for life. But he wants to say, if marriage has failed, then, you know, how do we deal with it, with that? And how do we keep people in the Church? And very important to this Pope, how do we keep their children in the Church? Because if people are told they can't go to communion and they stop going to Mass and then their kids don't go to Mass, you know, that's the denying their children something very important.
It was interesting that he issues this questionnaire to rank-and-file Catholics and wanting to get their views on the family, their views on sexuality. And I wondered what you figure he's going to do with this questionnaire. I mean, does it say something about the way a religious leader should lead in the sense that they get at least some sense of what the people in the Church itself are thinking?
Yes, well, I mean, he took the views of that came in from that questionnaire and fed them into the preparatory document on which the last discussions at the Synod were based. Mm. So the lay people have had their views input. Now, this is in huge contrast to previous popes. I remember in 1980, the Cardinal Hume in England presided over a thing called the National Pastoral Congress, which is ordinary people, priests, bishops, and they got together, 2,000 of them, and they discussed lots of issues and they produced a report. And Cardinal Hume went off to Rome and he gave this report to Pope John Paul and he held it open to him and he said, just read that page there, just read that. And the Pope just snapped it shut, handed it to an aide, and the message, Cardinal Hume said afterwards, the message is quite clear. Mm. We don't want to know what the lay people think. We'll tell lay people what to think. That's our job. Mm.
I wondered, this is Utah, headquarters for the Mormon Church. So we're often talking about Mormonism on this program. A few weeks ago, one of our guests mentioned that he believed the Mormon Church was stuck in a bit of a rut and that these well-meaning leaders were a bit out of touch, maybe a bit too rigid. And he said what the Church needs, the Mormon Church needs, is its version of a Pope Francis. And I wonder, do you think the Pope is being seen or could be seen as a model for other religions, other religious groups?
I would have thought so. Well, one of the things that's very striking about this Pope is by how well liked he is by people who aren't Catholics. Other denominations, Protestants, Episcopalians, Charismatics, they all love him because he's gone to their services when he was an Archbishop. The Jews, the Muslims in Argentina, they loved him because he was open to them. He had a Holocaust memorial in the cathedral in Buenos Aires. I mean, he's very open to other faiths, and as Pope, he's given interviews to atheists. And, you know, can an atheist go to heaven? Yes, of course an atheist can go to heaven as long as they're good people. Well, wow. You know, so there's a kind of sense in which he's trying to reach out with a message of the compassion of Christ to the whole world, not just to Catholics. And I think other people feel that sense of inclusion and feel that emotional warmth from him.
One of the things you try to get at in the book is, what is it that a future might look like under this pope? Where is the church headed? We talked a little bit about some of the resistance that was going on. We talked about some of the challenges he's going to be having reforming some of the institutions within the church. Is it too early to say where all of this might be headed and what the future might be under this pope?
In one sense, it's too early to say, but in other ways, no. We see the signals. I mean, he's appointed 39 cardinals. Yeah. Not one of them is an American. Hardly any of them are from Europe. Handful. Most of them are from places like Tonga and Burkina Faso and Haiti and Burma. You know, places that have never had cardinals before. So we're seeing that the College of Cardinals, the people who'll elect the next pope, are already, you know, the Europeans who were always in a majority are now in a minority. There are 42% of them from the developing world. If he has a couple more years of appointing 20 cardinals a year, you know, the makeup could be entirely different. But not just on that kind of procedural stuff, but also in the way that he is being pope, this kind of merciful, compassionate, warm. He talks about, we want the church of yes, not the church of no. That kind of sense will remain in the church, even if a new pope, you know, was a conservative and tried to row it back. There's a theologian who's got a lovely phrase, which is dangerous memory. Yeah. And Pope Francis will remain as a dangerous memory in the church, even if it were to veer back in the opposite direction. And people would remember that this man was a pope, and he said, you know, this is a different way of being a pope. It's a different way of being a Catholic, a different way of being a Christian. So that will always be there now. Mm. So something has changed, and you know, there's a genie that's out of the bottle.
Final question. There's this painting that's been important in Pope Francis's life, Mary the Untier of Knots. I guess that's how he sees himself. We've got less than a minute left, so maybe not a lot of time to tell that story. But would you say that what that reveals?
Well,
it's a
picture. Yeah. It's a picture which shows Our Lady untying the knots in a wedding ribbon. People used to have their hands bound together with a ribbon, and this couple had come to an old Jesuit and said, "We think we're going to get divorced." And he said, "Bring me your ribbon." And he held it up to a statue of Mary, and he said, "Untie the knots in this." And there was a painting done of Mary untying the knots, and Bergoglio came across it when he was in Germany, in at the beginning of that exile period. He had some time in Germany, and it spoke to him that he was a man who'd got his life ribbon in a tangle, and that Mary could help untangle it. And he feels that's true for the rest of the world. You know, there are knots, but they can be untangled.
Paul Vallely, his book is Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism, joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Paul, thank you very much.
That's been a pleasure. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Lindsay Vickers. The show directed by Tim Slover. Video West is produced by Josh Weathers. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.